My lord Intef's frustration and disappointment now were enough to make me feel a smug satisfaction as I considered what retribution must be in store for Rasva. He might have preferred more of the rough treatment that Tanis had dealt out to him to the punishment that my lord Intef would inflict upon him. My master was ever harsh with those who failed him. Tanis was still gasping from the exertions of the duel, but now, as he moved to the front of the stage, he drew a dozen deep breaths to steady himself for the declamation that would bring the pageant to an end. As he faced the congregation, it fell silent, for in blood and anger he was an awe-inspiring sight. Tanis lifted up both his hands to the temple roof and cried out in a loud voice, "Amun-Ra, give me voice! Osiris, give me eloquence!" The traditional entreaty of the orator. "Give him voice! Give him eloquence!" the crowd responded, and their faces were still rapt with all they had witnessed, but hungry for more entertainment. Tanis was that unusual creature, a man of action who was also a man of words and ideas. I am sure that he would have been generous enough to admit that many of those ideas were planted in his mind by that lowly slave Taita. However, once planted, they were infertile ground. When it came to oratory, Tanis' exhortations to his squadrons on the eve of battle were famous. Of course, I had not been present at all of these, but they had been relayed to me verbatim by Kratos, his faithful friend and lieutenant. I had copied many of these speeches down on a set of papyrus scrolls, for they were worthy of preservation. Tanis had the common touch, and the ability to appeal directly to the ordinary man. I often thought that much of this special power of his sprang from his transparent honesty and his forthright manner. Men trusted him and followed willingly wherever he led them, even unto death itself. I was still overwrought by the conflict we had all just witnessed, and the closeness of Tanis' escape from the trap that my lord Intef had laid for him. Nevertheless, I was eager to listen to the declamation that Tanis had prepared without my help or advice. To be truthful, I was still a little resentful that he had declined my assistance, and more than a little nervous as to what he might come out with. Tact and subtlety have never been Tanis' most notable virtues. Now Pharaoh made a gesture of invitation to him to speak, crossing and uncrossing the ceremonial crook and flail and inclining his head gracefully. The congregation was silent and intent, leaning forward eagerly so as not to miss a single word. "It is I, Horus the Falcon-Headed, that speaks," Tanis began, and they encouraged him. "It is verily the Falcon-Headed. Hear him." "Hakapita," Tanis used the archaic form from which the present name of Egypt was derived. Very few realized that the original meaning was the Temple of Ptah. "I speak to you of this ancient land given to us 10,000 years since, in the time when all the gods were young. I speak to you of the two kingdoms that in nature are one and indivisible." Pharaoh nodded. This was the standard dogma, approved by both temporal and religious authority, that neither recognized the impostor in the lower kingdom, nor even acknowledged his existence. "O Kemet!" Tanis used another ancient name for Egypt. "The Black Land, after the colour of the Nile mud brought down by the annual inundation. I speak to you of this land riven and divided, torn by civil war, bleeding and drained of treasure." My own shock was mirrored on the faces of all those who listened to him. Tanis had just given voice to the unspeakable. I wanted to rush onto the stage and clap my hand over his mouth to prevent him from going on, but I was transfixed. "O Tahmeri," another old name, "the beloved earth." Tanis had learned well the history I had taught him. "I speak to you of old and feeble generals, and admirals too weak and indecisive to wrest back the stolen kingdom from the usurper. I speak to you of ancient men in their dotage who waste your treasure and spill the blood of your finest young men as though it were the lees of bitter wine." In the second row of the audience I saw Nembet, the great lion of the Egypt, flush with anger and scratch furiously with chagrin at his beard. The other elderly military men around him frowned and moved restlessly on their benches, rattling their swords in their scabbards as a sign of their disapproval. Amongst them all, only my lord Intef smiled as he watched Tanis escape from one trap, only to blunder into the next. "Our Tapmeri is beset by a host of enemies, and yet the sons of the nobles prefer to cut off their own thumbs rather than to carry the sword to protect her." As he said this, Tanis looked keenly at Menset and Sobek, Lostris' older brothers, where they sat beside their father in the second row. The king's decree exempted from military service only those with such physical disability as to render them unfit. The surgeon priests at the temple of Osiris had perfected the art of removing the top joint of the thumb, with little pain or danger of infection, thus rendering it impossible for that hand to wield a sword or pluck a bowstring. The young bucks proudly flaunted their mutilations as they sat gambling and carousing in the riverside taverns. They considered the missing digit a mark not of cowardice, but of sophistication and independent spirit. "War is the game played by old men with the lives of the young," I had heard Lostris brothers argue. "Patriotism is a myth conceived by those old rogues to draw us into the infernal game. Let them fight as they will, but we want no part of it." In vain I had remonstrated with them that the privilege of Egyptian citizenship carried with it duties and responsibilities. They dismissed me with the arrogance of the young and ignorant. Now, however, beneath Tanus' level stare, they fidgeted and concealed their left hands in the folds of their clothing. They were both of them right-handed, but had convinced the recruiting officer to the contrary with their eloquence and a dash of gold. The common people at the rear of the great hall hummed and stamped their feet in agreement with what Tanus had said. It was their sons who filled the rowing benches of the war galleys, or marched under arms through the desert sands. However, in the wings of the stage, I wrung my hands in despair. With that little speech, Tanus had made an enemy of 50 of the young nobles in the audience. They were men who would one day inherit power and influence in the Upper Kingdom. Their enmity outweighed 100 times the adoration of the common herd, and I prayed for Tanus to cease. In a few minutes, he had done enough damage to last us all 100 years. But he went on blithely. "O Tatnutri!" This was yet another ancient name, the land of the gods. "I speak to you of the wrongdoer and the robber who waits in ambush on every hilltop and in every thicket. The farmer is forced to plough with his shield at his side, and the traveller must go with his sword bared." Again the commoners applauded. The depredations of the robber bands were a terrible scourge upon them all. No man was safe beyond the mud walls of the towns, and the robber chieftains, who called themselves the shrikes, were arrogant and fearless. They respected no law but their own, and no man was safe from them. Tanus had struck exactly the right note with the people, and suddenly I was moved by the notion that this was all much deeper than it seemed. Revolutions have been forged and dynasties of pharaohs overturned by just such appeals to the masses. With Tanus' next words, my suspicions were strengthened. "While the poor cry out under the lash of the tax collector, the nobles anoint the buttocks of their fancy boys with the most precious oils of the Orient." A roar went up from the rear of the hall, and my fears were replaced by a tremulous excitement. Had this been carefully planned? Was Tanus more subtle and devious than I had ever given him credit for? "By Horus," I cried in my heart, "the land is ripe for revolution, and who better to lead it than Tanus?" I felt only disappointment that he had not taken me into his confidence and made me party to his design. I could have planned a revolution as skilfully and as cunningly as I could design a water garden or write a play. I craned to look over the heads of the congregation, expecting at the very next moment to see Kratos and his brother officers burst into the temple at the head of a company of warriors from the squadron. I felt the hair on my forearms and the nape of my neck lift with excitement as I pictured them snatching the double crown from Pharaoh's head and placing it upon the blood-smeared brow of Tanus. With what joy I would have joined the cry of, "Long live Pharaoh! Long live King Tanus!" Heady images swilled before my eyes as Tanus went on speaking. I saw the prophecy of the desert oracle fulfilled. I dreamed of Tanus, with my Lady Lostris beside him, seated on the white throne of this very Egypt, with myself standing behind them, resplendent in the apparel of the Grand Vizier of the Upper Kingdom. But why, oh why, had he not consulted me before embarking on this perilous venture? With his next breath he made the reason plain. "I had misjudged my Tanus, my honest, plain, and good Tanus, my noble, straight, and trustworthy Tanus, lacking only in guile and stealth and deceit. This was no plot. This was simply Tanus speaking his mind without fear or favour. The commoners, who only moments before had been clinging enraptured to every word that fell from his tongue, were now quite unexpectedly given the sharp edge of that organ as he rounded upon them. "Hear me, O Egypt! What is to become of a land where the mean-spirited try to suppress the mighty amongst them, where the patriot is reviled, where there is no man of yesterday revered for his wisdom, where the petty and the envious seek to tear down the men of worth to their own base level. There was no cheering now, as those at the back of the hall recognized themselves in that description. Effortlessly Maitanos had succeeded in alienating every man amongst them, great and small, rich and poor. Oh, why had he not consulted me, I mourned, and the answer was plain. He had not consulted me because he knew I would have counselled him against it. What order is there in society where the slave is free with his tongue and counts himself as equal to those of noble birth? He blazed at them. Should the son revile his father and scorn the wisdom paid for in grey hairs and wrinkled brow? Should the waterfront harlot wear rings of lapis lazuli and set herself above the virtuous wife? By Horus, he would not spare one of them from the lash of his tongue, I thought bitterly. As always, he was completely oblivious to his own safety in the pursuit of what he saw as the right and open way. Only one person in the temple was enchanted with what he had to tell them. Lostris appeared at my side and gripped my arm. "Isn't he wonderful, Taita?" she breathed. "Every word he utters is the truth. Tonight he is truly a young god." I could find neither the words nor the heart to agree with her, and I hung my head in sorrow as Tanis went on relentlessly. "Pharaoh, you are the father of the people. We cry out to you for protection and for succour. Give the affairs of state and war into the hands of honest and clever men. Send the rogues and the fools to rot on their estates. Call off the faithless priests and the usurious servants of this state, those parasites upon the body of this Tameri of ours." Horus knows that I am as good a priest-hater as the best of them, but only a fool or very brave man would call down the wrath of every god-botherer in Egypt upon his own head, for their power is infinite, and their hatred implacable. While as for the civil servants, their lines of influence and corruption have been set up over the centuries, and my lord Intef was the chief of them all. I shuddered in pity for my dear blunt friend, as he went on handing out instructions to Pharaoh on how to restructure the whole of Egyptian society. "Heed the words of the sage. O king, honour the artist and the scribe. Reward the brave warrior and the faithful servant. Root out the bandits and the robbers from their desert fastnesses. Give the people example and direction in their lives, so that this very Egypt may once again flourish and be great." Tanis fell to his knees in the centre of the stage, and spread his arms wide. "O Pharaoh, you are our father. We protest our love to you. In return, show us now a father's love. Hear our entreaties, we beg of you." Up to that moment, I had been stupefied by the depths of my friend's folly, but now, much too late, I regained my wits and signalled frantically for my stagehands to drop the curtain before Tanis could do any further damage. As the gleaming folds of cloth floated down and hid him from their view, the audience sat in stunned silence, as though they did not believe all they had heard and seen that night. It was Pharaoh himself who broke the spell. He rose to his feet, and his face behind the stiff white makeup was inscrutable. As he swept from the temple, the congregation prostrated itself before him. Before he, too, went down in obeisance, I saw my lord Intef's expression. It was triumphant.